yet, in the South China Sea, we know that Beijing continues to coerce, to intimidate, and to make claims to the vast majority of the South China Sea.
Well, we know that the United States has little to no regard for international law and regulations. As a matter of fact, a couple months ago, there was an article published about the United States Coast Guard being in the, I believe it was Mediterranean. Now, mind you, why would the Coast Guard of the United States be in international waters unless the United States has no desire to keep international regulations and to follow international procedure?
In response to Harris's remarks, Chinese state media decried the U.S. vice president, accusing her of interfering in regional affairs by seeking to divide China and Southeast Asian nations to prevent Beijing's economic growth. China's state-run China Daily said in an editorial that while pointing a finger at China and accusing it of coercion and intimidation, Harris willfully ignored her own hypocrisy in attempting to coerce and intimidate regional countries to join Washington in a scheme to contain China. Seems that the United States' only commitment to Southeast Asia is its dedicated efforts to drive a wedge between the Southeast Asian nations and China. Meanwhile, China has accused Washington of bullying and hegemonic behavior. China's foreign ministry said that Afghanistan was one of the many examples defining what the U.S.'s so-called world order truly meant for nations.
The U.S. can come and go as it wishes and doesn't need to seek the international community's opinions, not even those of its allies. In order to defend America first, the U.S. can arbitrarily smear, suppress, coerce, and bully other countries and without paying any price. This is the order the U.S. wants.
The U.S. sees its rivalry with China as the biggest geopolitical test of the century. Southeast Asia has seen a series of high-profile visits by top U.S. administration officials, including the Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin, who visited Hanoi in late July. The visits have escalated tensions between the U.S. and China, which were already high due to a range of issues ranging from cybersecurity to human rights abuses.
The United States wants to destabilize China. China is an upcoming economic superpower. Its economy in some places has already surpassed the United States. China has a growing, the most large population in the world. It is sitting on trillions and trillions of dollars worth of important resources for modern technology. It's beginning to take a lead in the space race.
The South China Sea is a gateway to major sea routes, through which about $3.4 trillion worth of trade passes each year and contains huge gas fields and rich fishing grounds. China claims sovereignty over much of the strategic waterway and since 2014 has built artificial islands and reefs and installed military bases on them.
The Israeli regime is a sworn enemy of regional power Iran, and it makes no secret of its animosity towards the Islamic Republic, which is leading a regional front against the occupying force. The regime has assassinated several top Iranian nuclear scientists in Iran and is widely believed to have carried out sabotage attacks on Iran's nuclear facilities, which operate under the supervision of the International Atomic Energy Agency. Israel has recently escalated its anti-Iran rhetoric. This week, the regime renewed military threats against the Islamic Republic. The Israeli Minister for Military Affairs, Benny Gantz, issued a new threat against Iran's nuclear facilities. Gantz said Israel has the means to act alone and would not hesitate to strike Iran. He made the threat after once again accusing Tehran of orchestrating a recent drone attack on an Israeli-linked oil tanker last month. The Mercer Street was sailing in the sea off Oman on July 29th when it was struck. Iran has denied any involvement in that attack, but Tel Aviv is apparently using the naval incident as a pretext to rally its regional and Western allies against Iran. Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett, who is currently in the United States, is also trying to persuade the Americans to avoid diplomacy with Iran. The Israeli premier insisted that clandestine operations against Iran's nuclear program would not stop.
It's meant to create tension, and it is meant to try to push the Biden administration into disavowing negotiations with Iran. I'm quite sure that those negotiations will go on, even if, discreetly, even if there is a public avowal to support Israeli security.
Bennett seems to be on a mission in the U.S., pushing U.S. President Joe Biden to get tougher on Iran. Soon after arrival in the U.S., Bennett doubled down on his threats against Iran. Will that affect America's stance? The U.S. president has already refused to lift any of the sanctions that his predecessor imposed on Iran after unilaterally leaving the Iran nuclear deal in 2018. Biden was a vociferous critic of Donald Trump's Iran policy, but after several months into his presidency, he is still refusing to change America's course. Biden's stance has seriously undermined the prospect of a return to the 2015 nuclear deal, as Iran insists that the U.S. sanctions must be removed before the deal is restored. Meanwhile, the Iranians have made it clear that any attack on Iran would be met with ultimate force. Just recently, the commander-in-chief of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps warned that a mistake on the part of the regime would lead to its collapse. Major General Hossein Salami said the stage has been set for Israel's collapse in any future war.
It would defend itself with all of the military might it can muster. And in the case of Iran, that's quite a pit. And that is, again, why I say it is obvious to me, and should be obvious to most observers, that the United States does not want to get drawn into that type of a situation. I do believe that Israel fully understands that any attack against Iran would be a serious blowback to itself.
The regime could carry out more covert operations against the Iranians, further raising regional tensions. But if that happens and things spiral out of control, the regime has to be held responsible for instability in the region and beyond.
As the world witnesses the developments in Afghanistan following the chaos that ensued from the abrupt U.S. withdrawal from the country, questions are being raised about Washington's war on Afghanistan and its outcome. The Taliban swept through the country at a lightning speed and managed to take control of the capital, Kabul, in less than 2 weeks. Even the Pentagon officials expressed wonder at the rate at which provincial capitals across Afghanistan fell to the militants, as the U.S. intelligence services had estimated the Afghan capital would be isolated within 30 days and overtaken 2 months after. The harrowing scenes of chaos at the Kabul airport amid the evacuation of Western citizens and troops also drew criticism against how the foreign forces pulled out of the Central Asian country. Some observers are drawing parallels between the events in Afghanistan and the U.S. retreat from Vietnam Saigon after two decades of mindless violence in Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos. The scenes were also reminiscent of Israel's humiliating defeat in southern Lebanon in the year 2000.
Yes, I think it's a valid comparison, because both humiliating withdrawals came as a result of Western powers intervening militarily in states where they were not welcome. And they will continue to meddle militarily in the country. So I think one could say that national sovereignty and territorial integrity is not guaranteed for most of the countries of the world until finally the U.S. empire is brought down.
What do these historical events say about the U.S. and its ally Israel's influence in the West and Central Asia? The United States invaded Afghanistan in 2001 following the 9/11 attacks in New York with the stated aim of fighting terrorism. It removed the Taliban from power and installed a pro-Western government in the country. Washington has also been training Afghan security forces over the years, providing more than $80 billion worth of funds to build up the Central Asian country's 300,000-strong army. It has also trained 22,000 commandos and special forces in Afghanistan to defend against security threats. However, the number of attacks in Afghanistan saw a sharp growth since Western troops were deployed to the country. Furthermore, the costly training of the soldiers turned out pointless as they quickly surrendered to the Taliban amid the militants' incursion.
The fact that the U.S. is losing around the world and that Israel is losing its grip in the Middle East is due to the fact that people are resisting in the countries of the world, and especially in the Middle East.
The drawdown of the U.S. forces from West and Central Asia can also have implications for Israel, Washington's closest ally in the region.
It's true that Israel's power relies 100% on the power of the U.S. empire. And if the U.S. empire if people continue to resist successfully, and if the U.S. continues to weaken, then Israel's leaders might think about turning a new page. They might think about sharing the land with the Palestinian people, including all the refugees from around the world.
The events in Afghanistan in the past 2 weeks are going to be remembered in history books as yet another example of Western powers' failures after intervening in the affairs of countries where they are not welcome. The question is whether those actors will learn the lessons or if history will keep repeating itself.
Lately, the UN-affiliated Pan American Health Organization reported that COVID cases are accelerating in North America, driven primarily by a surge in southern and eastern United States and central Mexico. The spike is blamed on the highly infectious Delta variant of the virus. The organization stated that COVID cases in the United States are up by a third. The United States is currently the worst-hit nation in the world in terms of infections and fatalities. So, who is to blame for this situation? Last week, Texas Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick blamed the unvaccinated African American community for the latest COVID surge. The Lieutenant Governor's remarks drew criticism, as some called his assertion baseless. The latest data from the state of Texas Department of Health Services shows the highest coronavirus case rates are among whites and Hispanics, who make up over 70% of the state's cases, not the African Americans. Meanwhile, African Americans are more prone to the COVID-19 as they are twice as likely to die compared to their white counterparts. For instance, in the capital, Washington, D.C., African Americans account for 76% of the COVID deaths, while they make up less than half of the population. In addition, they are less likely to get vaccinated amid the variant spreads. African Americans have received smaller shares of vaccinations compared to their shares of cases and the total population. Out of the 58% of people who had received at least one dose of the vaccine, nearly two-thirds are white, and only 10% are African Americans. But COVID-19 is not the only problem they are facing. As the pandemic started last year, many working-class African Americans struggled with housing costs and faced eviction, as rent rates increased faster than their incomes. That's the best example of economic inequality in American society. Another issue that has plagued American society is racial discrimination and police brutality. According to various studies, African Americans are far more likely to be shot, arrested, and imprisoned by police than any other racial group. Many African Americans are reluctant to receive COVID jabs. This unwillingness is the result of distrust that formed after centuries of injustice toward African American communities. Vaccine hesitancy among African Americans is rooted in the historical mistreatment of the community by the U.S. government and medical institutions. One of the most horrific chapters in U.S. history is the infamous Tuskegee Experiment. In 1972, a report exposed that the U.S. Public Health Service had conducted a 40-year experiment at Tuskegee Institute in Alabama on hundreds of impoverished black men with syphilis. They were deliberately left untreated so doctors could study the disease. Many of the men died of syphilis and its complications. Some of their wives and babies were infected as well.
What was done cannot be undone, but we can end the silence. We can stop turning our heads away. We can look at you in the eye and finally say, on behalf of the American people, what the United States government did was shameful, and I am sorry.
The experiment added to the deep distrust many African Americans have toward the federal government.
Yeah, because, this idea of brutality, colonial brutality, has persisted throughout the history here. I mean, I know that some people would like to talk about Tuskegee, the Tuskegee experiment that lasted for 40 years here in the United States of America from 1932 to 1972, where white people used African men as test studies for the development of syphilis in human beings. And so some people say that our distrust being African people's distrust is based on that kind of history. But again, African people all around the world have sense enough not to trust anything that the colonizer says is good for us, because nothing they've ever said is good for us has been.
Racism and injustice, unethical medical experiments, and slavery all have contributed to the distrust that was in making for centuries.
A major report on climate says both greenhouse gas concentrations and global sea levels hit record highs in 2020. In this regard, we have prepared an article for Urian by Kenny Stansil, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Atmospheric CO2 Levels Haven't Been This High in 800,000 years, NOAA says. Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. Bolstering the case for meaningful climate action, a major report released recently found that Earth's atmospheric greenhouse gas concentrations and sea levels both hit record highs in 2020. Based on the contributions of more than 530 scientists from over 60 countries and compiled by the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, State of the Climate in 2020 is the 31st installment of the leading annual evaluation of the global climate system. The major indicators of climate change, officials from NOAA's National Centers for Environmental Information pointed out in a statement, continue to reflect trends consistent with a warming planet. Several markers, such as sea level, ocean heat content, and permafrost, once again broke records set just 1 year prior. Annual global surface temperatures were 0.97 degrees to 1.12 degrees Fahrenheit above the 1981 to 2010 average in 2020, said NOAA, making last year one of the three warmest on record, even with a cooling La Nina influence in the second half of the year. Last year was the warmest on record without an El Nino effect, and new high temperature records were set across the globe, NOAA said. The agency added that the past 7 years had been the seventh warmest on record. Although the coronavirus-driven economic slowdown resulted in an estimated 6% to 7% reduction of carbon dioxide, CO2 emissions in 2020, the global average atmospheric concentration of CO2 increased to a record high of 412.5 parts per million. The atmospheric concentrations of other major greenhouse gases, GHG, including methane and nitrous oxide, also continued to climb to record highs last year, despite the pandemic. According to NOAA, last year's CO2 concentration was 2.5 parts per million greater than 2019 amounts and was the highest in the modern 62-year measurement record and in ice core records dating back as far as 800,000 years. Moreover, the year-over-year increase of methane was the highest such increase since systematic measurements began. In addition, global sea levels continue to rise, surpassing previous records. NOAA said, for the ninth consecutive year, global average sea level rose to a new record high and was about 3.6 inches, or 91.3 millimeters higher than the 1993 average, which is when satellite measurements began. As a result of melting glaciers and ice sheets, warming oceans, and other expressions of the climate crisis, the global sea level is rising at an average rate of 1.2 inches, that is 3 centimeters per decade. Other notable findings of the new report include upper atmospheric temperatures were record or near record setting. Oceans absorbed a record amount of CO2, global upper ocean heat content reached a record high, and the global average sea surface temperature was the third highest on record. The Arctic continued to warm at a faster pace than lower latitudes, resulting in a spike in carbon-releasing fires, and minimum sea ice extent was the second smallest in the 42-year satellite record. Antarctica witnessed extreme heat and a record-long ozone hole, and there were 102 named tropical storms during the northern and southern hemisphere storm seasons, well above the 1981 to 2010 average of 85. In contrast to the release less than 3 weeks ago of the latest assessment from the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which warned that fossil fuel emissions are intensifying extreme weather disasters, provoking a flurry of reactions and even garnering a short-lived uptick in corporate media's coverage of climate emergency, NOAA's new report was met with less fanfare. In one of the few early statements issued by members of Congress in response to the report, Representative Eddie Birney Johnson said that scientists sounded the alarm on the climate crisis again. It is clear that without swift action, we can unfortunately expect to set new records like these every year, said Johnson, chair of the House Committee on Science, Space and Technology. The consequences of climate change impact every American, especially disadvantaged communities across the country. From devastating floods in Tennessee a few days ago to the record-breaking wildfires in the West. The lawmaker added, building a better future for all means acting on climate now. This situation is urgent, but it's not hopeless. We have an opportunity to lead the global response in the fight against the climate crisis. We cannot afford to waste it.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station.
I am a Muslim. Islam ID. Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all of time.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, boys and girls, other life forms. Welcome to today's episode of Youth Station. Thank you so very much for joining us here on IRB English Radio. I am your host, Zainab.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh. And I'm a co-host, brother Yasser.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thank you so much for being with us, bro. It's a scary world. It's a dark, scary, broken world. And I feel that I don't know whether it's getting worse and worse. Maybe humanity is reaching more awareness, more enlightenment, a better, deeper understanding of things, of life, of afterlife, and this and that. Like, racism was an actual thing. As a person from South Africa, you totally understand, right? And now it's illegal to be a racist. Not that it stops anyone, but still. But I feel some things about this world have not changed. Some dark aspects of it, the bloodshed, the injustice, the corruption, the extortion, exploitation, the state of insecurity that a lot of people are living in, women, children. And that scares me. Nature. The fact that in the past year and a half, we've had like 4 or 5 huge scale wildfires really scares me. Mm-hmm. And you know what, bro? It happens more than once a week.
You want to go to your cave?
Yes. I would like to crawl back into my cave now. I'm done with life.
I mean, what you mentioned is true. Like, there are certain things that happened. They've just changed the name. I mean, you see certain things, like, it makes you angry. Mm. I've seen certain things that really made me angry. There was one thing, I don't know how true or not it is. There's a lot of conspiracy theories regarding this and so on and so forth. About, for example, child trafficking, for example.
Oof.
That's one of the worst things that, it really angers me. And like, why would you do something like this? A kidnapping and then, extorting this child who has done nothing, and then you
put them in its life forever.
Whole life is gone,
Exactly.
And there's a whole discussion on recompensation and stuff of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, but that's a different discussion altogether. But the evilness that exists, torture, there's so many things you can speak about. But the thing that should give us hope, especially as Muslims, is that we have been promised a bright future. Mm. Something has been promised. That there will be a time where everything...
It's going to get better.
It has to. And it's a promise to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, says this, and it's a promise that the earth will be filled with the mustad'afin, those who are weak once upon a time. The hadith regarding the dhuhur of the Imam, ajalallahu ta'ala farjum sharif, and the time of that bright future, it's there. It should give us hope. One of the main goals of the dhuhur and of the reappearance is providing hope for the hopeless, which most of us are.
Beautiful.
Right. This is one of the things, and but it's up to us to kind of attach ourselves to that hope, not to lose hope. It's difficult. Like I said, saying these things is easy. But how would you? as a person who was in such a circumstance, you know. But then again, I don't know if you remember, it was a picture a few years ago about these Syrians in Damascus. It was they were having iftar together. Mm-hmm. So they had all these tables, and you could see on the
in
sides.
In the middle of rubble.
Just rubble. But you could see that they were, like, there was still hope. Now, if those people can get hope, they have, like, it will get better.
Mm.
A person who's living in a, put in inverted commas, first world country, who is depressed and so on. So not to say these are fake things,
mm-hmm.
but there is hope for you. Especially for those living in those first world, if a person like that can have hope of a brighter future, I mean, it's not far-fetched than everybody can, even if it's just a materialistic hope.
It is. I think, you know, there's a reason where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says that, don't lose hope in me, only those who are disbelievers lose hope in me.
Hmm.
Because once you lose hope in Allah, it is basically equivalent to giving up on life. And that is not what he wants from his Muslim servants. I feel like the world, in certain areas, it's becoming better. You know, I mean, people are recognizing like racism and sexism, and they are categorizing certain behaviors as abuse, as neglect, even in parenting, in mm-hmm. relationships, in work environments, in politics, which is good. Something, however, that I feel has been declining, like the melting of the ice caps of North Pole, is the degree and level of people's haya, their modesty. And I find it to be such a peculiar phenomenon. What in God's name is going on? And you see it everywhere.
Obviously, we know how this phenomenon started, where when a human being becomes the center of existence. And before we get there, there's actually a funny cartoon, as one of my friends once told me. It says when the Europeans went to North America, true or not, whatever, they saw the native Indians, or the native people, the Indians is a bad word, the natives of that particular continent, they weren't wearing a lot of clothing.
Yeah.
All right. And obviously coming from Britain, and in those days, you know, the ladies were fully covered.
Exactly.
With the hat. Yeah, something with that veil thing and everything. So, like, look how uncivilized these people are. Look how uncivilized these people are. Fast forward to post 9/11, where now, as you mentioned, where people are looking at us as a sister in hijab, who wears the niqab.
Is a terrorist.
It's a terrorist, and look how uncivilized they are.
Mm.
But me, as a woman, this. There's this group from France and Sweden. This is, I don't know what they call themselves, I can't remember, who go to protests without any clothing, and they do all this feminist type of things. It's a quite radical group. So they once protested about Muslims and hijab and stuff, and then the Muslims...
Why?
So the Muslims themselves said, this is my choice.
Yeah, if it's your choice to walk around buck naked, yeah, it's my choice to walk around covered.
I'm not being forced by anybody. But see, this is the thing, that when the human being becomes the center of the existence, and okay, I am a human being, therefore I say that, you know, my form and structure should be shown to everybody. And no one above me, other than myself, should tell me what I should or should not wear. But therefore you see that when a religion, which for them is man-made, seen by a person who lived 1400 years ago in some Arabian peninsula, tells you that you have to dress in this way, it's a kick in the face, because you are believing in something that is beyond the human form. So it's a philosophical war here.
Yeah. You're listening to Youth Station here on IRB English Radio. We're going to be back after a short break. Don't go anywhere. Allah, Allah, subhanallah, Allah,
Allah, walhamdulillah. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. If you have any suggestion, our email is EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Thank you for joining us again. You're listening to Youth Station. I'm Zainab, and my co-host is Brother Yasser. It's a scary world. It's a dark, scary, broken world. How can we not lose optimism in this situation?
Don't know. I mean, basically, just to mainly, like you mentioned, one of the things is to ignore it. Keep yourself occupied.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Ignoring always. Ignorance is bliss.
In this instance, definitely, it is. Just ignore it and keep yourself to yourself and don't really preoccupy. But what is worse is when Muslims themselves start talking like this. They say certain things not knowing the consequences of what they're saying.
Yeah.
Right? They might see this being something good, but the results of it may be very detrimental. And not understanding that who is using you for that particular, you've been used for a particular goal here. And you know, you as a sister and my, why do you think that the hijab is something that is directly attacked in all of these countries?
Because it directly stands against everything they believe in.
It is an apparent weapon that is directly facing them. It is not like, for example, you have belief, iman. There is something in your heart.
Yeah, they don't care about what's going on in your heart.
No one sees that, right? But it is these practical, visionary things that are in front of them where you are showing that, no, humanism is not something I believe in. A human being is a mere creation of something far greater. Exactly. God is the center of my world.
Yes.
Hijab is a direct thing against the philosophy that they have.
Yes. Oh, and they cannot stand it because...
Anything. Well, why hijab so much is because it is on a woman.
And they utilizing a woman has been one of their greatest means.
Exactly. I mean,
in reaching their objectives. Another thing that, off the back of a part of the things you said, regarding not losing optimism in this chaotic world that it just in some areas seems to be going downhill for real, is to be patient.
Patient, yeah.
Right, because when we look at the world and the immediate consequences of events, it always seems like the good guy comes last, the bad guy is victorious, the one who has the most money, most power, most contacts is victorious and triumphant, and no matter how much I try to be good, I'm still going to lose. Right? But we need to understand, number one, that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is always looking at the bigger picture. While He cares about each servant individually, He has this greater good to deal with, right? This whole bigger picture and the whole purpose of creation. And then on the other hand is that He just gives them time.
No, there has to be. There's a verse in the Quran actually regarding that. Just as you said, this says that those people who do these things, Allah says that I could have finished them here now.
In the blink of an eye.
But I give them the time.
Exactly.
There's two reasons for that. One is that there's a chance for them to return. Two, they're making their own afterlife worse.
Exactly. They're just digging their grave deeper and deeper and deeper.
So that's one of the things that is there. And the other thing that goes from an offshoot of the patience is to understand this is a test.
Yeah.
If you know it, that is a test in order for me to either pass or fail, the concept of patience, the concept of ignoring, the concept of all the other things that you have to do, find meaning.
There was a quote by one of these philosophers that says, the gist of it is that any pain is endurable once you find meaning in
it. Exactly. There's meaning.
Why do women put themselves through childbirth? Which is, identified as one of the worst forms of pain in the world because it has meaning to them, bringing forth life and continuing their legacy, their name, their blood, their whatever, because it has meaning. And once we can apply that to other forms of pain and struggling and struggles and suffering we have in our lives, give it meaning or understand that it has a meaning, in its own essence. Nothing in this world is... Pointless,
meaningless.
And that really helps us to a great degree to maintain that optimism, that hope, to stay clear of despair and hopelessness and to want to just throw our hands up and say, you know what, we're done. To hell with this. I'm done. the bloodshed that goes on, I think, is one of the hardest part of this world to deal with. But Allah sees what's going on. And like he promises in the Quran, he promises a lot of stuff in the Quran, but basically the gist of all of it is that everything's going to be okay. That's all the time we have for today's episode, you guys. Thank you so very much for being with us on today's episode of Youth Station. Until another greeting and salam, I leave you in the care and protection of the Almighty. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
In the limelight.
According to the Cost of War Project by the Watson Institute at Brown University, the United States spent $2.26 trillion on the war in Afghanistan. That comes to over $300 million spent every single day over the span of two decades. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Mike Mahari, writer. This article is published under the heading, U.S. Government Spent Over $300 Million a Day for 20 Years on Unconstitutional Afghanistan War. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. War is the parent of armies. From these proceed debts and taxes. And armies and debts and taxes are the known instruments for bringing the many under the domination of the few. Taxation not only steals U.S. wealth, it limits freedom. Access to few resources shrinks the number of options available to Americans. The more the U.S. government takes from its people, the more limited their options become. Everybody knows that it costs a lot of money to wage a war, and somebody has to pay for it. The U.S. federal government doesn't have any money of its own. Every dollar it spends eventually has to take from American people, either through direct taxation or the inflation tax, as the Federal Reserve prints money to monetize the national debt. After a 20-year unconstitutional war, the United States pulled troops out of Afghanistan. Within weeks, the Taliban had seized control of the country. How much did this debacle cost? According to the Cost of War Project by the Watson Institute at Brown University, the United States spent $2.26 trillion on the war in Afghanistan. That comes to over $300 million spent every single day over the span of two decades. This includes direct Department of Defense spending for the war totaling $933 billion, State Department outlays for nation building totaling $59 billion, base construction and maintenance cost of $443 billion, money spent caring for Afghanistan veterans totaling $296 billion, and the estimated interest payments for war borrowing totaling $530 billion. And what did Americans get for their $2.26 trillion? Absolutely nothing, and consider the loss of life. According to the cost of war report, between 238,000 and 241,000 people died in Afghanistan over the past two decades as a direct result of the war. That number includes 71,344 civilians, 2,442 U.S. military personnel, and 549 humanitarian aid workers, along with thousands of Afghan military and police personnel. As Madison, American philosopher, says, there are other intangible costs that Americans can't even calculate. They have seen a massive expansion of executive power. In 20 years of pursuing the so-called war on terror, the federal government has trampled the Constitution, ignored the limits on presidential war powers, expanded the surveillance state, claimed the authority to detain Americans on American soil without due process, and heaped piles of additional debt on American people. Not to mention the fact that the U.S. government diverted $2.26 trillion in resources to waging war, money that could have funded economic growth in the private sector. Who knows what the economy could have produced had all of that money not been funneled into making bombs and killing people over the world. On top of all of this, pile on the social cost, or as Madison put it, the degeneracy of manners and morals. When you add up all the costs, the final sum is a loss of liberty. Madison summed it up, no nation could preserve its freedom in the midst of continual warfare. You can't have limited government and perpetual war. The founders understood this and created a system that would make it difficult to drag the United States into military entanglements. Having unfettered itself from its constitutional restraints, war has become the default position for the U.S. government. And Americans have all paid the price. These undeclared wars have cost countless lives, trillions of dollars in treasure, and have eroded American people's liberties at home, just as James Madison predicted.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Zainab, peace be upon her, played unparalleled role on the way to Karbala with Imam Hussein on the day of Ashura with all those hardships and after Imam Hussein had been martyred. It is impossible to find a similar figure in history. Later on, numerous events took place during her captivity in Kufa and in Sham. Because of these great selfless efforts, Zainab al-Kubra gained a prominent position before Allah the Exalted. And this is something that we cannot describe. In the Holy Quran, Allah the Exalted mentions the names of two women as perfect examples of faith. God also mentions the names of two women as examples of infidelity. Allah sets forth for an example to the unbelievers, the wife of Noah and the wife of Lut. They were respectively under two of our righteous servants. The Holy Quran, chapter 66, verse 10. These two women exemplify infidelity. That is to say, Allah the Exalted mentions women, not men, as examples of both infidelity and faith. And Allah sets forth as an example to those who believe the wife of Pharaoh. The Holy Quran, chapter 66, verse number 11.
Ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum. أنا لاتشان.
Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, made the army of reason overcome the army of ignorance.
أنا لاتشان. أنا لات.
He mentions the wife of Pharaoh and Mary as two perfect examples of faith. And Mary, the daughter of Imran, the Holy Quran, chapter 66, verse number 12. A brief comparison between Zainab al-Kubra and the wife of Pharaoh would show the greatness of Zainab al-Kubra's position. In the Holy Quran, the wife of Pharaoh has been recognized as the example of faith for both men and women until the end of time. But just compare the wife of Pharaoh, who had faith in Moses' prophethood, and had been enchanted by his guidance, with Zainab al-Kubra. When she was tortured by Pharaoh, according to narrations and historical texts, she passed away due to the torture she suffered. She was frustrated by the physical pain. She said, "O my Lord, build for me, in nearness to you, a mansion in the garden, and save me from Pharaoh and his doings." The Holy Quran, chapter 66, verse number 11. In fact, she was praying for her death, and save me from Pharaoh and his doings. This was while her problem was only the physical torture. Unlike Zainab al-Kubra, she had not suffered the loss of several brothers, two children, and many of her relatives and nephews. She had not watched her dear ones go to the battlefield where they were supposed to be killed.
You've done.
around the world with reporters.
A scene of desperation transformed into one of horror in the waning days of the U.S.-led occupation. Two terrorist attacks on Kabul airport, claimed by Daesh. Dozens killed, among them children and U.S. troops. Hundreds more injured. British troops were spared this time. The U.K. Prime Minister says he's sticking to the evacuation plans.
The military, the Foreign Office teams, the Home Office, the Border Force teams are there getting people through as fast as they can still. And we're going to keep going up until the last moment.
That last moment comes on August 31st. Thousands, including British troops and eligible Afghans, are yet to be evacuated. And the threat of more attacks is looming. Pressure on the government over its handling of the crisis is mounting.
The Foreign Secretary shouts now, but he stayed on holiday while our mission in Afghanistan was disintegrating. You cannot coordinate an international response from the beach.
It's a shambolic end to a 20-year-long U.S.-led occupation, leaving ordinary Afghans to fend for themselves in a country torn by decades of war.
They invaded on a pretext, which was a false pretext, and then for 20 years they've spent $2 to $3 trillion destroying that country. The future in that regard is tough for the Afghani people. They're starting from a very low base as one of the poorest countries on earth, but there are resourceful, ingenious people who are well capable of lifting themselves out of their current situation.
The UK followed the US and their NATO allies into Afghanistan in 2001, purportedly to topple the Taliban, only to hand the country back to the militant group two decades later.
Imperialism invades for reasons of extraction of material wealth, to dominate markets, to dominate labor, to dominate resources. They had a geostrategic policy to dominate the oil of that region. Forget their talk about green energy. They want to extract the maximum fossil fuels from the Middle East and dominate every government, any government which stands in their way and is non-compliant.
The Kabul airport attacks will probably not be the last ones. A taste of what to expect in post-occupation Afghanistan.
Experts say what's happening in Afghanistan right now is another crisis created by an illegal war waged by the U.S., the U.K., and other NATO countries. Another example that military invasion or intervention is not conducive to stability or lasting peace. Saeed Pariza, London.
Turkey still seems to be undecided over the issue of the Kabul airport. The Turkish president said Ankara is still yet to decide on a request by the Taliban to run the airport. This came in a presser held in Atatürk Airport ahead of a trip the president is taking to Sarajevo. After Turkey's decision to withdraw troops located at the Kabul airport, the Taliban asked Turkey's assistance in operating the airport. Ankara says it isn't against the idea. However, there are certain things that the Taliban should provide first, such as securing the airport, especially after the latest bombing that took place on Thursday.
The Taliban have made a request regarding the operation of Kabul airport. They say we'll ensure security and you can operate it. But we have not made a decision yet because there's always the possibility of death and such things there.
Turkish president said the hesitation is due to several factors. The main one is the current power vacuum, assuring that a decision will be made once a new government is formed, and security is prevailed in Afghanistan. He added that commercial flights to Kabul will not be resumed now. Turkey urged the Taliban earlier to form an inclusive government, which includes former Afghan leaders. Ankara said those politicians have a certain credibility internationally and would help in ensuring political stability. Turkey is currently working to evacuate its citizens from Afghanistan. However, it seems that Ankara plans to accept Taliban.